believe that David is the author of this psalm, Psalm 84, that we're looking at this afternoon. It's very expressive of David. It's only David that cries out like this in verse 2, "My soul longs, yea, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God." That's very much expressive of David and his sentiments towards his God. He talks also in verse 9, "Behold, O God, our shield, and look upon the face of thine anointed." And of course he was anointed of God. And there's a lot of other things. The whole structure of this psalm is very much like David and Davidic, if that's the right word. And so let's accept that it's from David. And this again is so typical. As he introduces his psalm, he says, "To the chief musician upon gittith." Now, we don't know what kind of instrument gittith was, but we do know certain things about this instrument gittith. That is that it was made by the Philistines, which of course are the enemies of God's people Israel. And it was made by the Philistines to worship their god Dagon, which was one of the gods of the Philistines. Now the Philistines, of course, are the perpetual enemies of God's people Israel all through the Old Testament. They're warring and contending and fighting against Israel, always in this situation of contention and war and aggressiveness against God's people Israel. Well, they made this instrument gittith, did the Philistines, to praise their god Dagon. And they were only going to use it once a year. It was used in the gathering in of the grapes. And when they gathered in all of the harvest, the last harvest to gather in is the gathering in of the grapes. That's the last of all the harvests. There's no other harvest to come after it. The grapes are the last harvest. And the Philistines made this instrument particularly, expressly, for the worship of their god Dagon, for their gathering in of the grapes, for the last harvest, to praise their god for his faithfulness. Now, the course of life is such, the vicissitudes of life, the changeableness of life is such, that this, quote, worldly instrument, which was used by the Philistines, this instrument which was used by God's enemies, has now been taken out of their hands. And strange to say, Israel now has it. And now they are going to use it. And they're going to use it also at the same time of year. They're going to use it at the gathering in of the grapes, the last of the harvest, and they're going to praise their God for his faithfulness. So the instruments of sin, so to say, in this instrument, which have been created initially for Dagon, God's people had taken out of their hands. And now they were going to use it to praise their God for his faithfulness. It was true, springtime, summer, autumn had come upon them. Winter would soon be there. And God had been faithful. He had given them all of their harvests. And this now was the last of the harvest. And they were going to rejoice that their God had been so gloriously faithful to them again. And so they were going to worship him upon this instrument gittith. Ah, but you see, here is David. Now that would be all right, you see. But David comes along and he says, right, you know, if we're going to use this instrument, which we are, in the worship of our God, our glorious God, then there's only one person that can use this instrument. And that is a chief musician. We're not just going to have anybody, as it were, on this instrument. We're not going to have somebody practicing. We're not going to have a learner. What we're going to have is the chief musician. The very best that earth affords. We're going to have the chief musician. You see, he says, when we come to the worship of God, it's not the leftovers. It's not the novices, so to speak. What we want is the best. And that's what we're going to aim for. Nothing less than the best for our God. I mean, he's worthy of our worship. If he's worthy of our worship, then indeed he must have the best, not the leftovers. The number one, the chief musician. This is who we're going to have to play upon this instrument. Let him come with all his expertise. Let him come with all his knowledge. Let him come with all his ability. Let him come with all of his God-given gifts. And he's going to take hold of this instrument, whatever it was like, and he's going to play upon it, the like of which we haven't heard for 12 months. And it's with expectancy that we come into his courts to sing his praise. And how we're going to praise him. We're going to praise him being led by the chief musician. He's going to set our souls aflame. He's going to set our hearts a burning, so to speak. He's going to play like he's been waiting and practicing for 12 months, this instrument to play in the worship of his God in the gathering in of the grapes. To the chief musician. To the chief musician. And my dear ones, this is what God expects from all of us. Not the leftovers. Not the end of the week, so to speak. But the beginning of things. The best of things. The glorious fruit of things. The chief musician. And who's going to sing? Who's going to sing? Well, it's going to be the sons of Korah. And who are the sons of Korah? Well, they all belong to their father, Korah. And you know about the rebellion in the book of Exodus. You know, somebody come up with a socialistic idea that this is how Israel is. We're all on the same level. And Moses and Aaron, you've taken too much upon yourselves. You know, who on earth do you think you are lording it over the Lord's flock? Who on earth do you think you are? You know what we'll do is we think we're as good as what you are. Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and I. And those were the rebels that rebelled against Moses and Aaron. And Moses said, well, all right, I'm not going to say anything. All I'm going to say is we're going to stand over here and you can stand over there and we'll just see what God does in you guys standing over there and we standing over here. And you know what happened? The earth opened and Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On went down into the pit of life, and we read in the narrative they went down with their wives and their children. But you see, God is a God of grace. Even in an act of judgment. Because there are remnants here who have been rescued from that sure and certain destruction. Sons of Korah. They've been snatched, as it were, as brands plucked from the burning. And the amazing thing is, you see, that they are the singers, the choir. And they're going to sing. Now they recognize full well that when they come into the courts of the Lord, where they ought to be, where they should be, apart from God's grace. So I tell you this, you see that when they come into the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts, and when they're going to lead the singing, nobody on earth, but nobody, is going to sing like these sons of Korah. Because they recognize the pit from whence they have been rescued. So what are they going to sing about? What are they going to sing about? The loveliness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. And only they could sing about the loveliness of the tabernacle. Because they know full well the awfulness of the caverns of the damned. And because they knew the awfulness of the caverns of the damned, they knew the loveliness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. And when you've been to hell and snatched out of it, then there's none like you that can sing about the loveliness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. See, we've got a song that even angels cannot sing. You see, last night in that parable, you see that they're looking into these things. You know, here is this great rejoicing. Now, they don't quite understand it. How can they understand it? How can they understand it that rejoice with me, for I have found the sheep which was lost? But how can they rejoice? They've never known what it is to be lost. They've never known what it is to sin. They stand in that holy place without sin, without the knowledge of sin in that sense. They don't understand these things. They look into these things. It mystifies them. It blows their brains, so to speak, to pieces. They can't comprehend the song of a sinner that has been forgiven. We have our own choir in heaven. The angels have their choirs. And what glorious choirs they're going to be, but we have our own choir. And we're going to sing a song that even angels cannot sing, though we're lesser creatures than them. We're going to sing a song of a sinner that has been forgiven, who's been redeemed, who's been ransomed, who's been healed, restored, forgiven, who like us his praise should sing. So David says, when we come into the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts, what we're going to have is a glorious processional. And what the processional is, you see that first of all comes the chief musician upon Gittith, and he's going to lead the processional, not with a cross, but with an instrument. And he's going to play upon it, man alive. And here comes after him, you see, the choir. And they're going to sing about the loveliness or the amiableness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts, and what a meeting it's going to be. So he says, a psalm for the sons of Korah. And my dear ones, if you come into God's house, and when you come into God's house, you recognize that by nature this isn't your house, but the caverns of the lost is where you ought to be, then none like you would be able to sing of the amiableness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. So the psalmist says, how amiable are thy tabernacles? How amiable? How amiable are they? He doesn't tell us how amiable they are. You know, how can you possibly express the loveliness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts in an earthly language? I'm not advocating that you speak in tongues. But how can you possibly speak about heavenly things in an earthly language? John is on the Isle of Patmos on the Lord's Day. He's in the Spirit, and he writes for us the book of the Revelation. And he says, you know, it's like this, or it's like this, or there's some beasts, and they look something like this, and they like this, and there's a bit of this, and there's a bit of that. And he's looking for words to try and express just what he's seeing. It is just like this and like that and like something else. And that's how he can express it. And that's the only way that he can express it. All he has is an earthly language. And he's talking to earthlings. So therefore he's got to have the language of earth in order to express something which is of heaven. And that's a sheer impossibility. Amen. And he says, how amiable. But he doesn't tell us how amiable it is. The Scots have a phrase. It's better felt than told. It's better felt than told. It's better felt than told about the amiableness of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. And then we have verse 2. He says, my soul longs, yea, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. My soul longeth. In the first verse he's talking about how amiable are thy tabernacles, O Lord of hosts. And then the second verse is saying, my soul longs for. So obviously he's lost something. And he's lost, how lovely are thy tabernacles. And he's not where he used to be. And he's not what he once was. And he's not where he used to be. He says, my soul longs, yea, even faints for the courts of the Lord. He remembers, you see, better days. Do we look back on better days than what we have today spiritually? Can we remember glorious days? Perhaps when he was a little boy, he was going with his father Jesse and his other brothers. They went along that dusty road and came over the hill, and there was the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. It was only covered with badger skins. It didn't have a steeple. It didn't have gold-plated doors. It was just badger skins. Now you know full well that skins, you know, have a smell about them. However well they are treated, they're going to have a smell. I went up in the north of Norway, went up there a number of times, but on this one occasion I was with those Norwegian Lapps, and there were some Christians, a number of Christians among them, and they were very generous. They gave me a number of horns, and they gave me a reindeer skin. And okay, I said thank you very, very much, and I drove back from Norway and caught a ferry out of Oslo, or Bergen rather, and ferried across the North Sea and back to a place on the east coast of England and back to Birmingham. And I thought I was bringing my wife something home, this reindeer skin, beautiful reindeer skin. I'd been well treated and all the rest of it. As soon as I walked in the house, and I said, "Well, guess what? Well, I've got for you a beautiful skin. Here it is." So she took one look at it. She said, "I don't want that stinking thing in this house." And I said, "Well, it's a reindeer skin. I mean, I don't care what it is, but you can take it out of the house. I'm not going to have it in here," she said, "because it smells of blood. I can smell it here." No, it's been treated. "Well, I can smell it here. Well, I'm going to put it up on the wall." "Well, you can do what you like, but I'm not going to live in this house if you're going to put it on the wall." So we nearly got a divorce on the spot. But I did put it up on the wall. You know, usurp your authority. So exert your authority. And I put it on the wall, nailed it on the wall, fixed it on the wall. And of course, every so often, you know, the sun would come through the window and hit this skin. And she'd go through the house and say, "What on earth is that smell?" "I don't know. It's that skin. Get it off the wall." So eventually we had to have the skin off the wall, in all due respects to those dear Norwegian Lapps that gave it to me. Well, skin smell. But it's interesting, you know, there was nothing very attractive on the outside of this tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. And yet David said, I can remember going along there with my dad and brothers and coming into this smelly place. I mean, the heat's beating down on it. It's in the Middle East. I mean, Saudi Arabia, your kids are complaining about the heat that's out there. I mean, this is what you have. Heat. So those skins are going to smell all the more. There's no air conditioning there. But there was the light of another world. And there was the glory of the mercy seat, and the singing of those Levites, and the choir, and the playing upon this instrument giddeth. And David says, "I can remember going in there, being so aware of the presence of God." And he says, "My soul longs for." Why I preach like I preach is because I have known him. I've known when I've been in meetings, when I put my hand to my face and we've been praying, and I dare not open my fingers or my eyes for fear of seeing him and he killing me. Been such an awareness of the presence of God in the flesh. And I tell you, if you've known something of heaven, then the mediocrity of this world is a little comfort. And David says, my soul longs for. You see, my dear, when we need for God to arrive and come because of our sin. Now, I may know something of the movements of God. My son does. And my grandchildren certainly. Those yesterdays to come back to today. And the psalmist says, my soul longs, yea, faints. You know what it is? It talks about my soul is homesick in the Hebrew. I am homesick. I am pining away for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. You see, a living man must have a living God. And if you once tasted that the Lord is good, then you can never be satisfied with the mediocrity of this world.
Right.
If we once tasted that God is good, if we know something about the living God, then because we are living creatures, because we are indeed servants of the living God, we must have a living God and nothing else will do. So my dear one here this afternoon, long for and faint for the courts of the Lord. And then the psalmist remembers something. He says, yea, the sparrow found a house. You see this little worthless thing called a sparrow, it's found a house. It's found a place where it may reside. And if you're not a member of this church and you're drifting around from place to place, you shouldn't be. Because sparrows have houses. And you need to have a house. Yea, the sparrow hath found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars. And David remembers this little sparrow and this little swallow. The sparrow, the most worthless of birds. The swallow, the most restless of birds. You boys go out with your BB guns and shoot the little sparrows out of the trees. I don't know why you do, but you do. Sparrow, too soul for a father, not of no consequence whatsoever. And yet the psalmist says, one of these little worthless little things has found something of infinite worth. And what this little sparrow has found is a house, even alongside the altar, to build its nest. And the swallow, the most restless of birds, which is careering across the heavens all through this summer and have now gone to a warmer climate, even than Texas. You see, these swallows screaming across the sky. They can't settle. It's very, very, very difficult for them. That tiny little feet. And they only land occasionally, you know, to pick up mud to take it back and make a mud nest on the side of your house. And the swallow hath found a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars. So the swallow is one side of the altar of the Lord, and the sparrow is another. And it's teaching the whole congregation, these little creatures are bringing up their little ones as near to God as they possibly can. Even thine altar. And my dear ones here this afternoon, will you learn a lesson from the sparrow? David said, I wish my home was like this. I've got an Absalom though, that's the problem. Perhaps I wouldn't have an Absalom, he's saying, if I had been like the sparrow and the swallow. And my dear fathers here this afternoon, you know, if you bring up your little ones around the altar, they're not going to fly far away. Do you ever get the family together? Do you ever pray together with your wife and with your kids? Do you find time? See, that's the point, you know. Wherever your priorities are, you'll make time. You'll make time. And God has met with us. You have a responsibility now. Responsibility is not on your wife's shoulders, it's on your shoulders. But Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones always used to say, there's more men in the pulpit. that there were less women in the pew. Not a lot of men in the pulpit. There's a lot of women in the pulpit. That is, men dressed up as women, so to speak. You know what I mean? So if there's more men in the pulpit, there are less women in the pew. There's more women in the pew than men. Some have gone wrong with our ministry because we don't believe it. And a lot of men don't believe this. Believe it. Go to your mother. See what she says. Oh, why? Can't be bothered. You know the story of little Jimmy, don't you? He was always asking his father if he could go out fishing with him. But Jimmy got a new rod for his birthday. And Dad was always saying, I can't. See, I've got this computer, son. You see, and this computer is locked into a lot of other computers. And I'm in the stock market. I'm in the stock exchange, you know? You know, and getting away from this computer, you know, for half an hour, I could lose thousands of dollars, son. I mean, you wouldn't have any fishing rods. You wouldn't have a boat to go out on the lake. If we lose all this, I can't be bothered. It was constantly the cry of the father, the little boy's cry. Then one day, little Jimmy insisted, Dad, I want you to come out fishing with me. Tomorrow. I can't come tomorrow, but I'll come the day after. And little Jimmy went back to his desk and wrote on his diary, going fishing with Dad the day after tomorrow. So the day came, and Father had almost forgotten it, but because of his promise, he said, all right, I'll come. So he goes out fishing, and all the time he's thinking about the computer and the stock exchange. When he gets back, there's a note on his desk. By his secretary. I'm sorry because I couldn't contact you. You have lost, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, I don't know. There's a great amount of money, dollars. And the man was mad. He goes to his desk diary. And he scrawls right across the page for that day. A whole wasted day fishing with Jimmy. And I lost $60,000! Exclamation marks. Jimmy goes back to his little desk and to his little diary and says, great day, spent fishing with my dad, caught two fishes! Exclamation mark. Do you ever pray with them? Do you ever gather them together? It only takes a few minutes. And the family that prays together sticks together. I mean, you've done everything with your wife, husband. I mean, you've won. And so won that you have little children. Have you ever gathered them around you at the end of the day and say, well, I don't know much, kids, but let's turn to Psalm, whatever it may be. And just read a few verses. Do you see what it says? It says this, it says that, it says something else. Now, darling, how have you got up today? You see, you think, you men, that you're the only guys that are working. And really, you see, what your wives have been doing is talking to little critters right down here. And a friend of mine, she said, you know, she said to me not so long ago. One night I was so fed up. Got three little kids. And they're all talking Donald Duck language, you know. And she said, when Jim came home, picked up the magazine and started to read it. And I said, Jim, darling, speak to me. Please speak to me as an intelligent being. All I've heard today is Donald Duck, Donald Duck, Donald Duck. And please speak to me intelligently. Let's have a conversation. Let's use my brain. You've had a busy day. What do you think I've had with these three little Donald Ducks? And it's true. And it's true. And the sparrow found in this. Hey, your family altar. Getting out the book, praying together. Going through your problems together. Oh, what needless pain we bear. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. All because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. And the psalmist says, the sparrow hath found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself. Don't you know what happens to the swallows? They always come back to the very place where they were born. If you've had them on your house this year, you've only had one, you're going to have three or four of them next year. Because the little ones have flown away, and now they're going to come back to the very place where Dad brought them up. And that's the problem with swallows. And you can break down their nest, but that was the vicinity that they were born and brought up in, and so they're going to come back there, irrespective of what you're going to do next summer and knocking them off your house. And my dear ones, your little swallows may fly away for a time. But if you brought them up around the altar of the Lord, they're not going to fly very far, because they're going to come back to where Mom and Dad brought them up. You train a child in the ways of the Lord. I don't care about your Ishmaels, and I don't care about your Absaloms or anybody else. But my Bible says this: He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that's what I'm sticking by. And I have a daughter who's not where she ought to be. But you see, the last chapter about Bev has not been written yet. She's going to come home where she was brought up. No doubt about it. It's inevitable. And these kids, you see, whatever happens to them as far as the days that lie ahead, they're going to come back to last night. Never be able to get away from that. Whatever happens to them, they're going to come back to the altar of the Lord. I'll never be able to forget that. And the sparrow have found a house. And the psalmist goes on in verse 4, oh, how blessed are they that dwell in thy house. And dwell there is to do with marriage. It's like settling down. It's not in and out and saying goodbyes and what have you. But it's something which is fixed. Blessed are they that are fixed in thy house, or rather are married to thy house. They will be always praising thee. They will be still praising thee. In other words, in the Hebrew, they will always be praising thee. There will not be a time when they will not be praising God. Now that's difficult, because sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But you see, if you dwell in the house of the Lord, will you say, I've got to go out to business every day? Our brother was complaining that he got to go back to work. Was it Monday and Tuesday or whatever it was of this coming week? And this was irksome. But you see, it is irksome. I understand what that's all about. But it says here about those that dwell in thy house, and you say, well, I've got to go out to work. I can't come to God's house every day and sit on my knees or pray on my knees all day and dwell in the house of the Lord. No, 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 no. It's talking about an attitude of heart. I mean, you can be hammering nails, and you can be in the workshop, you can be at the factory, you can be in the office desk, you can be at home, you can be by the sink, you can be putting all the dirty washing in the washer, but you know, you can be, as it were, in the house of the Lord. Your heart and your mind is in tune with God, and you're constantly talking with Him. You know, this is what I do all the time. I'm in His presence. I can't help but be in His presence. I need Him. I need Him all the hours of the day. I need Him all of the time, and so do you. And oh, how blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be always praising thee. When trials and problems and difficulties come our way, you see, if we're in touch with our God, then He gives us strength, and He gives us grace, and He gives us enabling. This is the practicality of Christianity. It's a glorious life to live. Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be always praising thee. Oh, how blessed is the man in whose strength is in thee, in whose heart are the highways to Zion, who passing through the valley of Baca make it a well. The rain also filleth the pools. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them in Zion appeareth before God. You see, what the psalmist is saying here, blessed are they who dwell in thy house. There will be a strength about them, in whose heart are the highways to Zion. You see, there are communications in the heart of this one. You know, there are things that are happening in the interstate, so to speak, between heaven and earth. You know the story of Jacob and Joseph. Jacob was far off from Joseph. And the brothers come and they tell their father, Joseph is yet alive. We've met him. And Jacob says, no way. No way, he's dead. And so the brothers go back to Joseph and they say, you've got to do something about convincing our dad that you're alive. And Joseph said, I'll convince him. You go back, you tell him that I'm alive and I want him down here with me, and I'm going to send him something to convince him. And so we read in the narrative in Genesis 45, and they told him, that is Jacob, all the words of Joseph which he said unto them. And then we read these glorious words, but coming down the road with the wagons that Joseph had sent for his father Jacob, and Joseph and Jacob said, and when Jacob saw the wagons, verse 27, which Joseph had sent to carry him into Egypt, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived, and Israel said, it's enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. If you dwell in the house of the Lord, if you dwell, make this indeed your aim and your ambition, that constantly you're going to be in touch with your God. Then the point of the matter is, you see, you'll know something of the wagons coming every day from Joseph to tell you he's still on the throne and he's got a lot waiting for you just down the road. And to prove that he's got a lot, he'll just send these few wagons with a few samples of what he's got for you. And old Jacob, when he saw the wagons, yeah, it's got written all the way across the sign, I love your dad, Joseph. I love your dad, Joseph. Jacob said, yeah, that's Joseph's handwriting, all right. Yeah. I'll yet go down. Thank God for the wagons. My dear ones, have you had the wagon? Yeah. Have you heard the wagon wheels? Hey, they make a bit of a noise, these old wagon wheels. Have you heard them? Have you seen them? Joseph is yet alive. You see, this person, in whose heart are the highways to Zion, who sees something about the wagon, they go from strength to strength. They're not petering out. Not many of you have got grey hairs. Looks as though I'm the only one that's got grey hairs among you. Well, you know the whole tragedy is, you hear about grey hairs? People are always opting out of society. Let the young ones do it. Because you know I'm getting tired and not as young as I used to be, so let's pass it over. Oh no, the older you are, the stronger indeed you should become. Do you know the tragedy of our grandparents today? Y'all want to know about this, that, and something else? I don't want to be that kind of grandparent. I want to keep going till I drop dead. That's got to be good. Going on from strength to strength. from glory unto glory, as Wesley says, till in heaven I take my place. What a way to live. I don't want to be stuck along the side of the church wall, so to speak, as I said this morning in an illustration, waiting to die. No, sir, that's no kind of life. May have grey hairs, but we're going on from strength to strength, because you know why? The wagons. Seeing the wagons. Joseph is yet alive. Thank God for that. And he gives me samples every day. And the point of the matter, you see, when you come to the Valley of Baca, what's the Valley of Baca? Well, the Valley of Baca is a place where the pilgrims had to pass through on their way to Jerusalem. And it has nothing, no watering holes, no green grass, no trees, just whited bones of people that have perished in the Valley of Baca. Well, who wants to go through the Valley of Baca? Well, it's appointed unto all of us at one time or other in our life to go through the Valley of the Shadow of Death, to go through the Valley of Baca. Well, the man in whose heart are the highways to Zion, who knows something about the wagons coming every day, when he comes to the Valley of Baca, you know what he does? He transforms it to a well of water. Did I ever tell you, when I was preaching on this before, about an old pastor that I, in whose church I used to minister many years ago? We used to have, in the days of campaigns, you know, and we used to go around the area inviting everybody to come to the services. And this old boy was dying. He got angina. Lived in a beautiful house. Got a great big sun window, we call them, a sun trap window. And he looked out over his beautiful garden. It was all landscaped. And this is what the man delighted in, better than the guy on the opposite side of the road to you. It was all landscape, beautiful green grass, flowers, shrubs, you know, bulbs. Everything was flowering at one time of the year. It was all mapped out. And this is all he lived for, apart from his ministry, of course. Ministry came first, and then his garden came afterwards. And this is where he lived in, and he loved it, just loved it. But now he had angina, and he couldn't do anything. Like a wilderness. And he was reminded of it every day because of his great big sun window. But that's where he sat, in that one room. And he couldn't go out. Couldn't go upstairs to the bathroom. So they brought the bathroom into that one room. And the only way he was going to get out of that room was in a coffin. So what are you going to say to this man? So I went in and I said, I was staying with him for the day. And I said, "Oh, Mr. Howe, how are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, boy. Hey, see that chair? Pick it up, come and sit in." Picked it up, sat by. Said, "Look at it. Well, the outward man is perishing every day. But oh, God, the inward man. You know, the wagons come every day. Little samples from heaven, you know. And they're filled to overflowing. There's this one, there's this one, there's this one, there's this one. Samples all around. Man alive, I have not seen nor ear heard. You know, I mean, the wagons have been coming for a long time now, Gordon, and they continue to come, and it's fresh every day. Nothing stale about it. And it's so glorious." And I'm looking at it. I said, "You remember, you know, when we used to go out and we used to have the meetings, invite all the people, go around house to house, knock on the doors, invite them to come. Nobody came. Now they've heard the old boy's dying. Now their consciences are beginning to prick them. So they're concerned about the old minister at the end of the road there that's dying. Don't you think we ought to go along and see how the old boy is and say, 'Well, how are you? Sorry we haven't been to your church for a long time,' etc., etc.?" So they come. And they come in, they knock on the front door. They come in, "I'm waiting for you." And they sit in that chair where you're sitting. And I start to tell them about. And he said, "You know, it's a funny thing. I see them falling off that seat again and again. And they get on their knees and they cry to God. And I'm sitting here and I can't do much about it. And I just leave them to God and he saves one after the other. And there's more being saved here in this room, Gordon, than in all the years when I was there in the pulpit in the church. And do you know what, Gordon? I'd rather be like this than what I was like that." And then he went on to say, "Thank God for the angina. Because you see, Gordon, if it wasn't for the angina, I wouldn't have known this. And this is what I prefer. see he in whose heart are the highways of Zion with the wagons. Hey, he's going to change the valley of Baca into wells. You know, I thought, what on earth am I going to say to this guy? He had something to say to me. He gave me some water to drink out of the well of Baca. And that's a glorious well. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them in Zion shall appear in Zion before God. And then he says, behold, O God, our shield, and look upon the face of thine anointed. And I'm finished.